Assalamu alaikum. So thank you, Humayun Sahab, for that very kind introduction. Ashraf Sahab, IPR, the Chamber, and to all of you for coming. It's always a pleasure and privilege to be speaking. I have to say today it makes me nervous because there are people in this room who've actually dealt with the crises that I have looked at in my book. And so I better not get anything wrong. Actually, there are more than just three or four as I look around. There are people who actually were part of the military then or were actually dealing with this as diplomats and otherwise. So I'm going to try and be cautious. But what I thought I would do here, rather than sort of give you a long-winded summary of the book, is to draw out some lessons from what I looked at. In terms of the conversations that we have as Pakistan about this issue and what I found to be counterintuitive. Let me begin by saying why I actually did this book and then sort of I open up to a bit of substance. The first reason for this is that as I looked at this subject, the first file on my computer of this book, which came out this year, of course, is 2009. So it took me about 9 years to figure out what I was doing. And the reason for that was that if you look at scholarship on Pakistan, we continue to talk about this in a very negative way. And the normal conversation is that the world is looking at Pakistan unfairly. The world portrays Pakistan more negatively than it should. The focus is on wrong things, etc. And the question I always used to ask myself is, how many Pakistanis have actually written about Pakistan? And the answer is very few. And the Pakistanis who have written on Pakistan on various things, some very, very good work has been done. The problem with that, not the problem, but the sort of focus of much of that is narration. It's anecdotal work. It's people who are policymakers or others who've given some very good thought to very important subjects. But there's no real original theoretical formulation or modeling of what happens. And much of Western literature actually derives from theories that then they apply to various countries, and oftentimes we argue that they get it wrong on Pakistan. Well, partly they get it wrong because the theories are not based on the context that they are studying. So that was my basic idea, to actually produce something which was original in scholarship, whether good or bad, to at least start a debate on how we could look at this differently. Not necessarily as a Pakistani, because that's not what a scholar does, but to look at it differently than a traditional Cold War lens when it comes to things like India-Pakistan confrontation. So that's essentially, if there's one thing I want the book to be remembered for, that's really what it is. The practical reason of doing the book was that since 1998, if you go back and listen to speeches of Pakistani leaders, Indian leaders, in May 1998, the one commonality you'll find is that now we have declared our nuclear capability, we are no longer beholden to international pressure. You know, the conversation was about that we will not need to now bend over backwards to accommodate the US and everybody else. There is going to be more strategic independence in decision making. At least that was one of the slogans that came out, both from Pakistan and India. This wasn't out of thin air. If you look at all of the Cold War, one of the arguments made for nuclear weapons was strategic independence. You have greater space to maneuver in international politics. When I started looking at South Asia, the very first thing I realized was that the US is front and center of any crisis conversation in this part of the world. And what I started detecting was that actually US leverage post-1998 increased, not decreased, when it came to crisis moments. So that's the puzzle I started to unpack as to why it is counterintuitive. After nuclear weapons, there should be more independence in decision making. Why was there less of that post-1998? From that, I got to the point where my basic argument in the book is that throughout the Cold War, there was one problem in the way we argued the case for nuclear weapons. The argument in the Cold War was the US and Soviet Union have nuclear weapons. They are the strongest powers, and thus nobody else can influence their behavior, especially during crisis moments. And what I discovered in my book was that it's actually not nuclear weapons that made them immune to pressure of other parties. It was basically that there was no other third party that was stronger than the US and Soviet Union to influence their behavior. So when it comes to regional nuclear states like India and Pakistan, I argue that you will always have external pressures and greater external pressures, because now the world is really worried that the consequences of war would not only be India and Pakistan fighting each other, but a human catastrophe of uncomprehendable proportions. And so when I unpacked all of this, what I realized was that it wasn't that India and Pakistan were asking the US and China and Russia and others to come and manage the crises. It was the US primarily, but others as well, of their own accord, worried about escalation of the conflict to a nuclear level that would show up day one to ask India and Pakistan to de-escalate tensions. Now, we often hear in India and Pakistan that the US and others exaggerate the risks of nuclear war. For instance, in Kargil, there are people here who dealt with Kargil. There was really no nuclear element to that conflict beyond the fact that India-Pakistan had declared nuclear capability. It is true that third parties exaggerate the risk of nuclear war. But the reason they exaggerate is not because they want to make a point. It is because the US understanding of nuclear weapons is derived from the Cold War, where the number one lesson in 1990 was that nuclear war will not happen because two nuclear states want it, but it may happen despite them not wanting it. It was this worry about inadvertent accidents and escalation that drives US behavior. And what I found was that any time there is any nuclear contest, just the presence of nuclear weapons in an environment is enough to get the US bureaucracy right at the top, the National Security Advisor and the President, etc., involved on day one. So this idea that India and Pakistan have to solicit the US to come and manage crisis, I actually find to be wrong. The US will show up whether India and Pakistan want it or not, with one principal goal, which is de-escalation of the crisis. It's also interesting that we talk a lot about the fact that the US is now leaning towards India, you know, China towards Pakistan. Is the US an honest broker? You always ask this question. How can we trust the US? The US is not honest. Well, it turns out that the period that I studied, 1998 to 2016, essentially Kargil 2001, 2002, Mumbai, and then the surgical strikes episode, which wasn't as big a crisis. But in any case, there was no moment that either India or Pakistan trusted the US. There's never a single crisis in which either we or India trusted that the US was honest in its brokering. But what I discover is that it's actually not trust that matters. It is the perception that the US has leverage over your opponent to get what you want that drives India and Pakistan to engage the US and other third parties. So if India or Pakistan believe that if the US really wanted to push the opponent to deliver whatever you're asking, it has the leverage to do it, you are more likely to engage the third party than not. And the reason that the US becomes important in these crises, and the reason India and Pakistan engage them, is that India and Pakistan have a very simple choice to make. It's not out of love for the US or China or anybody else. The choice is that if the US is going to show up, or other third parties, powerful third parties are going to show up of their own accord to manage a crisis, and you choose to defy that third party, you basically tell that third party, I don't trust you, you can do whatever you like. You have just opened the window for your opponent to curry favor with this third party and gang up against you. So it's really this fear that the US will team up with your opponent that forces India and Pakistan to engage the US to try and get whatever concessions they can from this external actor. The other reality is, whatever we may say, India and Pakistan have no bilateral escalation control mechanisms. Once you're in a crisis, there are hotlines, there are communication channels, which either are not used, or when they are used, they're only used tactically to avoid an immediate escalation. But beyond that, trust levels are so low that India and Pakistan find it easier to engage the third party to try and get the third party to deliver concessions from the opponent than doing this directly. And thus this third party called the US in my case, but increasingly I think China over time, and perhaps Russia in the future, is entrenched in crisis management in South Asia post-nuclear tests. Now, I'll also tell you something interesting. There are people in this room who I interviewed for this book as well. When I asked policymakers in India, in Pakistan, in the US, and I've done close to 100 interviews of sort of actual crisis management managers, US secretaries of state, Pakistani prime ministers, Indian prime ministers, etc. All three of them said, what you're saying makes no sense. We never engage this third party. We are sovereign states, we make our own decisions, we are nuclear powers, we don't need third parties. When you ask the US, they would say, well, they're sovereign states, we will only go if they ask for help. Then I started putting evidence in front of people. And all of them then told me, actually what you're saying is exactly right, we can't acknowledge it publicly. The point I want to make is that there's a serious problem here when it comes to diplomacy and crisis management. And there are seasoned diplomats sitting here who can bail me out. If you are not willing to acknowledge what you do in a crisis, there is no way for you to learn lessons. You spend more time denying what had happened than actually drawing lessons to see how you can do what happened better next time round. When this book came out, as you can imagine, sort of officials or the government systems from all three actors, US, India, Pakistan, approached me and said, well, this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong. And I asked one question to everybody, especially in Pakistan. I said, yeah, you're telling me I missed this, I should have said this, this is not right, that's fine, that's it, we can debate that. Have you actually gotten your teams to sit down and draw lessons of what we did right and what we did wrong, which we should do next time? And to the T, everybody had a blank face. So my only plea to people is, let's forget about what I've got right or wrong. But what are the lessons that we can draw from this going forward? And unfortunately, the number one lesson that I'm told is, we cannot trust the US, we are not going to engage them again. The problem is, as I've explained to you, the US is built into the model. It is not a choice at the end of the day, unless we want to risk US teaming up with India, or India wants to risk US teaming up with Pakistan, or China teaming up with Pakistan. The rational move here is to engage the third party to gain whatever concessions you can. For the third party, interestingly, let me also point out, we talk a lot about the US teaming up with India, etc. The third party's hand is constrained because their number one goal is to avoid nuclear war. And if they believe there is a risk of nuclear war, they're going to be more worried than the reality of the risk of nuclear war. And thus, the US is never going to side with India or Pakistan completely if it feels that its behavior is going to increase the risk of escalation. The reason it teamed up with India to a large extent in Kargil is that the world had actually declared Pakistan the aggressor and India the victor. So that became the most efficient way of forcing Pakistan to withdraw, which the US felt was the way to get to de-escalation. But if you look at 2001, 2002 and Mumbai, for instance, where in Mumbai, the cards were very much stacked against Pakistan because of the context of Mumbai. Actually, the US did not back India against Pakistan. It very carefully balanced while pressuring Pakistan to deliver on certain things on the militants. Ultimately, the message to India was absolutely clear again and again. Do not use military force. And in fact, there's a quote in my book, a US diplomat quoting the Indian strategy said, actually, India's plan A, plan B and plan C in Mumbai was to bank on the US to deliver concessions from Pakistan from day one. There is another very interesting quote that I got from somebody who I won't name because it's an anonymous quote. Somebody very senior in the US administration who was working on the Mumbai crisis at the time. He said the number one goal for the US was to find a good enough excuse for India to back down. So yes, there was tremendous pressure on Pakistan. But the pressure was driven by the need to get certain things from Pakistan to tell India to back off. And I would argue that the US would do exactly this, irrespective of what its relationship with India and Pakistan is in the crisis moment. What will change in the future is one of two things. One, the US may be more willing to put and impose costs on Pakistan after the crisis, after de-escalation has taken place. In peacetime, the US may be much more willing to impose costs on Pakistan, especially if the Afghanistan problem is behind us. And second, the big change now is, we don't know whether the US and the Chinese can coordinate a crisis strategy going forward. In the past, the interesting thing I will tell you is that the Chinese, the Russians, the Brits and everybody seamlessly lined up behind the US to de-escalate the crisis. And one of the things I mention in the book, which is very counterintuitive for those who practice diplomacy, larger foreign policy interests of the US and China and others are suspended in time during the crisis moment. The alliance structures take a back seat, and the number one goal is, how do I get to de-escalation? So I'll give you an anecdote and a couple of other things, and then I promise to shut up. The anecdote is that in the Mumbai crisis, the National Security Council of the US, the White House essentially, was bifurcated into two offices. One that managed Afghanistan and Iraq. You'll remember Iraq was still a big thing at the time. And another office that managed India, Pakistan, and the rest of South Asia. The office that managed Afghanistan, which was US's number one goal in the region at the time, were never invited to any meeting of the principals where the crisis was discussed. This was a deliberate choice to ignore the impact that the crisis would have on Afghanistan while trying to find de-escalation. So I'm not saying it will go to that extent every time, but really this is about de-escalation. The other thing I'll very quickly mention to you that we talk about quite often here is public pressure. There's so much public pressure that the leadership will have to do something. And in fact, Shahid Sahib, you were the High Commissioner during Mumbai. One of the big things that Pakistan was pleading over and over is, we can't hold back if India does something. And the Indians were making the exact same case to the US. Look at what's happening. 150 people dead. How can we hold back? Get us what we want or else. And what I find is that Indian and Pakistani governments are masters at using public narratives. In fact, they are much more likely to use that pressure to signal to the US and others that if you don't get us what we want, something will go wrong, then truly feeling the heat of doing something because of public pressure. So the Indian surgical strikes and that entire conversation had very little to do with public pressure. There have been attacks in Kashmir before that and after that, which we haven't heard of. That was a conscious political choice by the Indian government to up the ante. Just like many perhaps have forgotten, but one of the biggest casualty incidents in Indian Pakistan history since 9/11, there was Mumbai and there was the Samjhota train bombings in which scores of Pakistanis were actually killed. Nobody remembers that because Pakistan made a conscious choice not to create a crisis out of that moment. So the point to keep in mind is, public pressure actually is fairly well managed, in fact sometimes manufactured, in India and Pakistan. But the US and third parties take that public pressure to heart. That narrative always works with the third party, and they get even more worried when they come into work this. Finally, on this point, the US is not an honest broker in the sense of mediation. The US manipulates the situation. Every third party manipulates the situation. They use information very carefully. They provide certain information. They hold certain information back. Sometimes information is manufactured with one goal in mind: end the crisis. In Kargil, Shamshad Sahib would remember, there was this famous July 4th meeting between Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and President Clinton, in which one of the things President Clinton mentioned was that the Pakistani military is moving nuclear weapons. That, as I understand, had a impact on the Pakistani Prime Minister's decision to withdraw. The intelligence report was wrong. It was provided, but President Clinton, interestingly, before the meeting, told his cabinet that I'm going to use this information to scare the hell out of the Pakistani Prime Minister. Similarly, in 2001-2002, there was intelligence that the US actually shared with India that prevented India from taking a limited military action in January 2002. Turns out that information was shared on Pakistan's prodding. So, you know, this is very calculated and calibrated, and I'm actually surprised as to how in sync messaging becomes during a crisis. Even with Pakistan and India, where usually, you know, things, if you turn on the media, you feel everybody is going out and doing whatever they want to do. During a crisis moment, that's not the case. The reason the US is central and the way it uses its leverage, and maybe China in the future and others, is one, superior intelligence, and second, they act as an information conduit between India and Pakistan. So everybody who talks about hotlines and direct communication, we need to keep in mind that the third party has no interest in pulling itself out and allowing India and Pakistan to go at it directly. In fact, they want to be in the middle of that communication because that's how they use their leverage to share certain information and withhold certain information. And that's sort of what the US does. And at least in my book, I argue that the third party is so entrenched that it's not going to change. Not for India and Pakistan, not for a nuclear Iran and Israel, not for a North Korea. Any regional actor will have more powerful parties interested in de-escalating the crisis. The final point, and I'll end on this, is that the world is still to unpack and study the risks of this model. Everything we know in nuclear environments comes from the Cold War and is bilateral. The US versus the Soviet Union. What does the involvement of the US do to the crisis model? What do India and Pakistan do in return, and whether that increases the risk or reduces the risk? What will the current US president say when he picks up the phone to de-escalate the crisis? How will India and Pakistan react? Where would the Chinese fit into this? Too much effort has gone into, to my mind, trying to convince everybody that the bilateral equation still holds. And the third party is an external actor and we should just push it away and work it out among ourselves or between ourselves. That's not going to happen. The US will show up, India and Pakistan will utilize that opportunity. And so the quicker we can get to finding a way to reduce the risk of this indirect communication, US, Pakistan, India, the better it would be for peace and stability here. But again, I keep looking at literature, pushing very hard to say the answer for India and Pakistan is to get the US out and directly deal with this issue. Well, it's easier said than done. If the US shows up, we're going to use them. If we're going to use them, we better know how to do this as India and Pakistan and the US, quite frankly, also. If the US-Pakistan relationship breaks tomorrow, the US leverage disappears. And we've got a whole new conundrum to deal with. Because the Chinese are very clear when you talk to them, we are not prepared to play the US in a crisis. We will stand back and support, but we are not ready to come front and center. So who else then? That's essentially, at the end of the day, where I sort of throw a bit of caution there. Let me stop there.